I'm here with singer-songwriter Mary Chapin Carpenter.
And I'm here with poet, author, and educator Sarah Kay.
Welcome back to our third and final episode of One Story. In the previous two episodes, we dug into songs and themes of Mary Chapin's new album, The Dirt and the Stars. Today, we're looking at her career and influences. It had been a long time since I had heard the song, He Thinks He'll Keep Her.
Oh, yeah.
And I started to listen to the song, and I knew, like, immediately my whole body started to harmonize every line of the song. And I was like, why do I know all the words to this song and every harmony part? Like, what is happening in this? And I had these memories start to come back. And when I was a 14-year-old, I got invited to do like a girls' leadership weekend at Mount Holyoke College. And it happened to be literally the weekend that I started Project Voice, which is now my life's work.
Right.
So the weekend that I started Project Voice, I got to go to Mount Holyoke College. It was my first time on a college campus. And there was a girls' group and they were singing a cappella, and I'd never heard a cappella before. And they gave me an a cappella CD that I took back with me to high school, and me and my friends wore that thing out.
That's
and
great.
One of the songs was an a cappella version of He Thinks He'll Keep Her. And so not only did that song to my bones, I also
know
every harmony part on it by heart.
I mean, there's music that I would describe the way of what you just said. I know every harmony part. My body knows the parts. I know it on a cellular level.
Yes.
I feel that way about the entire Beatles catalog. And it doesn't take anything for me to be able to just, I hear it, I start singing along, I know the harmony. Yeah, exactly. When you know something on a cellular level, right? It's or I like to say that it's sort of just tattooed on my on my insides.
In researching and getting ready for this conversation, I noticed that any interview with you, there's always a lot of talk about influences, right? You're incredibly generous with the way that you shine light on other people's work and their importance to you in your life. I find there's like different categories of influences, and there's heroes, and those are the people that I think of from afar. So maybe like the Beatles. People whose work you kind of study or model yourself after or idolize with like a distance between you as like a hero. And then that's a different group of people in my head from like mentors who are people who you work with or maybe have, you know, memories with.
Or I was going to say that a mentor is someone that you actually have had actual contact with.
Yeah, that's how I think of it. And that you know that there's at least one moment, if not multiple moments, where you can feel their hand on the scale of you. Right? And I know—
Even if they don't even know.
Right, exactly. You
know, yeah.
Exactly. And I know there's a story that I've heard you reference before, which I think of when I think of that category, maybe like Joan Baez. Is that a person that you would consider a mentor or not necessarily?
Well, I would, based on what I just suggested, it require that you have actual contact with somebody. She would definitely be in there because I met her when I was, you know, 16 in the most bizarre of circumstances. And then all these years later, whenever I'm with her, I am always forever my 16-year-old self. You know, I'm never who I am now. I'm that in awe and in respect and admiration. It's magical to be around her.
When you met her, was she a hero who became a mentor? What was your relationship to her work in the moment that you met her?
You know, I will say, I don't even know if she knows that she is a mentor. She walks through this world in amazing ways. I grew up in a house that had music in it all the time. And my parents had Woody Guthrie records and Joan Baez records and Fats Waller records and opera and the Metropolitan Texaco Theater at 2 o'clock every Saturday afternoon, live from the Met, would be blasting through our house. And my dad had a jazz collection that was extraordinary. So I grew up with just knowing the music and the names of Joan Baez and Louis Armstrong and Pavarotti and whoever. So when I met Joan when I was 16, and I suppose I should try to just explain that really quickly.
Please.
For my junior and senior years in high school, I went to a school in Connecticut, and there was this common room where you'd leave your backpack all day, and it had two pianos. The nose of each piano faced itself. So,
oh wow!
So you
like
you,
dueling
you
could, piano style?
Yeah, you could see who if somebody was playing the other one, you'd see them directly across from you. And I would go into the common room after school hours when no one was in there, and I'd bang around on the piano and sing to myself. It was just what I loved to do. I don't play piano well at all. The dog runs when he sees me go over to the piano. But I would just like to play and sing. And so I was there one late Sunday afternoon. The place was deserted. And I was just singing a song. And I noticed in the shadows that somebody was standing in the doorway. And again, it's a public space, so it didn't startle me in any way. But then all of a sudden, in the shadows, someone steps up to the piano directly across from me. And I see this person and I think, well, I know who that is, but why would she be here? And then she starts playing along with me and singing harmony. But whatever the song was, I don't remember now, but it was something that she knew the song. And then we finish the song and there's just sort of this silence. And she comes over and she sits down next to me and she asks me what my name was. And then she says, well, I've got time for one more. What you want to sing? And I said, yeah, sure. But then I turned to her and I said, you're Joan Baez, aren't you? And she said, mm-hmm. And I said, okay. Then we play another song and then she gave me a hug and she left.
Wow.
And it was like, what just happened? Why is she here? What it was that one of the students at the school, his family, it was Tom Styron, William Styron's family. And Tom was a classmate and he would stay there at the school during the week, but he lived close enough that he could go home on the weekends. And he had been home and Joan had driven him back to the school. And he was just walking her through the halls.
Wow.
And that's why she was there. She was spending the weekend at their house. And so then fast forward the tape to many, 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 many years later. And I'm invited to participate in this beautiful, magical project that comes and goes over the years called Four Voices. And it was Joan and Amy and Emily, the Indigos, and myself doing concerts on behalf of organizations and causes that we believed in. And I told Joan, you're not going to remember this, but I met you when I was 16. And she said, tell me. And so I told her the story and she said, I wouldn't have remembered it, but now that you shared that with me, I do.
Wow.
And I just think that's crazy. And so every single time I gotten together with her to play or be part of a show, you can imagine it, that 16-year-old self just can't believe that all happened in all these years throughout. She's recorded one of my songs, which was the greatest honor I think I've ever felt about anything.
So she's a person that you would consider a mentor. Are there other mentors that are either mentors that you hold in a similar space or mentors whose work is especially important?
You can go to a concert and mm-hmm. sit in the third row and watch someone's hands on the guitar. To me, that's another version of sort of having a lesson.
Oh, totally.
I've learned a lot just by watching people playing. So in the same vein, I think that if someone's work, you know, has really sort of informed how you do what you do and what you're passionate about and all those things, you may never meet them, but you can consider them a mentor because you're learning things from them. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Absolutely.
So that's why I sort of think that there's a way to think about that without actually ever knowing someone.
Sure. Yeah, I oftentimes think about, I call it an apprenticeship.
And yes, I think exactly.
I talk a lot about learning poetry via apprenticeship. And mm-hmm. my personal experience with poetry is I didn't fall in love with poetry in a classroom nor mm-hmm. a textbook. And I fell right. in love with it in a dive bar. But that's really the way that I learned about poetry and found love with poetry was just being in a specific space that allowed me to witness and like soak up all of these different people's art. And I think maybe the distinction that I would make there is it's almost like the art I was making, like the poems that I was making, were not necessarily anything like the poems that they were making, but my approach to poetry, I learned from them, from watching their approach to poetry, right? So I apprenticed myself to their craft.
Yes, that makes so much sense to me.
You have created 15 studio albums, is that right now?
I think that's what it is, yeah.
Unbelievable. I imagine when you were 20, 23, you were not like, all right, here we go, 30-year career.
Are you kidding? My head just exploded. I've always walked around with that imposter syndrome or something where somebody's going to find out that I don't have a clue what I'm doing. And it's all been a extraordinary accident. But they're going to find out and then I'll be gone.
Do you mean to tell me that 15 studio albums in, yes, we still don't get rid of the imposter syndrome? Are you kidding me?
Isn't that terrible? But it's true. And I probably don't feel that way on a day when I finished a song that just makes me feel like, okay, I know what I'm doing here.
Yeah.
I know what I'm doing. And so it's that the imposter syndrome is dormant for that period of time, but it always rolls right back eventually, you know? And I think it's probably most in the shadows or dormant when I feel really engaged with what I'm doing, which you're writing and you're really content with what you're doing and you feel very immersed in it.
Mine is the opposite of yours, I think.
Really?
Oh, yeah. When I'm trying to write, it's real loud. And it's like, what are you doing? Like,
don't put words
next to each other. This is a terrible decision.
So what do you do when you are up against that? How do you get through it or go through it, go past it, overcome it, talk it away, talk it down?
I think one of my favorite writers and friends is, and mentors, all the categories, is a writer named Hanif Abdurraqib. And he talks a lot about giving himself over to his curiosities. And I think when I feel less like my job is to create something and more that my job is to follow my curiosities about something, it feels a little more process focused and a little less product focused, right?
Right.
So I'm not going like, I have to write a poem. I'm going like, I have to follow this and see what happens.
Right.
And sometimes what happens is a poem, but oftentimes not the case.
I think that's a wonderful way to describe it, because when you're able to clear away all the sort of self-conscious stuff and the, can I do this, and have given yourself over to a subject or a thought or a feeling that you're trying to describe, when your craft kicks in, right, all that other stuff is gone. And the imposter syndrome, I think, is far away. And so you're able to bring your craft in and rely on that. That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah.
And then what about on the performance side of things? Because I also have, like, I'm backstage, right, before I go on,
What are you doing? Do you get nervous?
Oh, my God.
Because, of course, I would love to talk about this with you, because it's something that I have been so curious with other people. And certainly it's something that I've had to work on for years and years and years. But tell me what you feel like when you're standing on the side of the stage.
Well, I didn't.
Because when we see you doing what you do, right, no one would ever know.
I think what it is, you know, I did not originate, I think, with a desire to be a performer. I sort of tumbled backwards into performance because I happened to fall in love with a type of writing that was happening on a stage.
Right.
Now that I've been doing it for a long time, I take the performance very seriously and consider it a part of the craft and work on it and practice it. But I don't think I was like a natural performer. I think it's taken a lot of work. And so when I think about performing specifically, and when I think about, like, here I go, getting on stage, doing the thing, it is terrifying. It is terrifying every single time.
Yes.
And one of the things that has reassured me in my performance anxieties is, like, I'm performing me when right. I get on stage. And right. I am saying words that only I know for the most part. And if right. I mess up a line or I change a word or it's not how it was yesterday, nobody is going to know. And right. I get to pretend like that was the plan all along. Right. Singing in front of a room full of people, to me, genuinely terrifying. My worst nightmare, karaoke. Worst nightmare. Despite the fact that, like, I'm a lifelong singer, I've been in singing groups my whole life, doesn't matter. Yeah. I'm always going to be the one harmonizing. I'm always going to be the one standing behind the soloist. Yeah, yeah. Because to me, when you're singing, the risk of that is like the room knows when you're wrong.
Yes, they do. But everyone has always said this, and as an audience member myself at times, I totally get this. But when it's you on the stage, it's always hard to believe. But that is that people always say, when I express my fear of screwing up on stage or forgetting words, being too nervous, whatever it is, people always say, nobody cares.
Yeah.
They're happy to see that you're human. If anything, they don't want you to be in distress, so they want to be helpful, you know? And so nobody cares. And if they do, then maybe, you know, they'll ask for their money. I don't know. But, you know, it just... But it's hard for I think, us to believe,
yeah,
just if only because we have our standards for ourselves and we want to feel like we walk out there and have all of our powers that we use to do what we do. So
I'll tell you what, though, there is a moment when I'm on stage when I nail it and I can feel it. And I'm like,
and what
does
that, what does that feel like?
It's, I think, the one moment where the imposter syndrome melts away.
That's so right. And in the last few years, it's been very important to me to finish every show by thanking the audience for coming out to support live music. Stating the obvious, we have these screens that we carry around in our back pocket, and they can deliver any book, any poem, any video, any movie, any painting, any work of art. They can deliver pretty much our heart's desire on that screen. But in my opinion, there's never going to be a substitute for what it feels like to be all together in a room and to be on that little trip, the sense that we're all going to go somewhere together tonight and we're all connected in that way. And so I really always want to just make that point and thank the audience for coming and allowing this moment to take place. And everyone always responds in the most beautiful way. And the other thing I was thinking of when you were speaking was, I'm curious to know if you have felt for yourself the growth and the evolution of being a performer in a way that, for me, when I started out, oh my God, I was so terrified and I was so shy and I couldn't think of what should I say between a song or the, oh God, it was so hard to feel at ease under the spotlights and with all eyes on you and them waiting for you to take control and go somewhere with this. And it, again, it just has taken years and years, but I finally, in the last number of years, it's like, you can't shut me up. I just can't. If it's an intimate enough space or a certain kind of audience, I always like to just chat the audience up and ask if anybody has any questions. And the hilarity and the loveliness and the connection just grows enormously with opening it up that way. And I just love to hear what people think. And I love to know anything they want to share about themselves. And it's just, it's resulted in some of the most fabulous interactions, completely spontaneous. But it's taken me many years to sort of find that spot on the stage and inside of myself to find that place of calm and confidence to be that kind of performer. Having just said that, the first couple of shows of every tour, oh my gosh, it's like, where's the exit? I need to run away right now. I'm so terrified. It just takes a while to get your sea legs, right?
Yeah.
And so that's always just a part of it. But it's just a, it's, I love to hear how other people do what they do. It's fascinating to me.
Since we're already talking about them, let me just ask you, like, who do you think of as quote unquote your audience? And I guess maybe paired with that, how much do you think of them, or when do you think of them? Like, are you already thinking about your audience when you're writing a song, or the writing is all for you? It's totally personal. It's a self-excavation. Mm-hmm. And then it's not until you're standing in front of them, or it's not until you're starting to record an album. Like, when do they come into the picture for you?
I honestly don't want to have those kinds of thoughts. I think they could be inhibiting, you know, make you self-conscious. It just, if you haven't even finished the song and you're thinking about, well, how is it going to be received and by who, then that could very easily kind of skew what you end up writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, another way of looking at that, or shooting holes into what I just said, would be, you know, well, wait a minute. There's a lot of incredibly gifted, like, pop songwriters who write to or for an audience, and they're incredibly good at what they do. And the songs they come up with are the greatest ear candy you've ever heard. And we all need those. But back to just talking about us, you know, I don't want to feel like that's kind of in my brain when I'm writing. So to try to answer your question, I don't think I think about the audience until I start rehearsing a show. And then I'm very keen on trying to write set lists that I think will result in that thing that I keep talking about, that that this evening that we're going to try to have together is like taking a journey. And the set list is the biggest guide to that. And so that's when I'm thinking about the audience and thinking about who's there. When I look out into the audience, albeit without my contacts and my glasses, but when I can see, I see so many different faces, so many different ages, so many different shades of skin color, so many different couples, so many different families. And that is what makes me happiest.
Yeah. Do you feel like that part of it, has that changed over the course of time? When you started, did you have a specific audience and that has broadened, or it's always kind of been that way?
You see yourself in your audience. So I see an older audience as time has gone on, which makes sense to me. But at the same time, I see younger people too. And that always just gives me so much joy, because you want to feel that you're speaking to everyone at all different times of their life. And that seems to be affirmed to me when I read people's comments online. They tell me who they are and how old they are and how they came to the music and all of that. So I feel like it's sort of verified to me that way. And that makes me so happy as well.
Yeah, me too. So my mother's mother, my grandmother, who is not alive anymore, when she was a younger woman, her kids got her a cassette deck, and she would listen to your cassettes next to her desk.
No.
Absolutely.
Oh, God.
And I think just the idea that myself and my grandmother could both have our own relationships to your music, to me, is something about a very big word, which is legacy. But I also think that especially women artists and women artists who have had the immensity of a career that you have had, they don't get asked about legacy enough. And I really wanted to ask you about whether you think about legacy, whether you've always thought about legacy, whether it's something that you're now thinking about, or what does it mean to you?
Well, first of all, it makes me so happy to hear that she had that little cassette recorder and that she listened to the songs and that there's a connecting thread between you in that sense. I'm just really humbled by that. And thank you for sharing that with me. I feel like I'm still the same person I was when I'm 17 or maybe 21 inside. It's just that I don't feel like any time has passed from the times that the person I was inside then. I know that physically, obviously, I'm not. But it's like I'm just always sort of surprised when I'm having to like fill out a form and I'm 62 years old, because it's not that I'm embarrassed by that or don't accept my age, but I just don't ever think about it really. And the only time I've ever really thought about, like the last few years, we put out a record to celebrate 30 years of making records. And it's just, I can't even really wrap my head around 30 years. That just, wow, okay. We're still here. We're doing what we love. We're so lucky to be able to still be here. There are realities that I just seem to escape me, like, well, you know, there have to be people who want to hear what you have to say. And I don't know if that's good or bad. Is that good or bad?
I think that there's no good or bad. I think more perhaps I was just wanting to acknowledge that, like, you have had 30 years of creating art that people have relationships to.
It's very humbling.
And it's also just very impressive. Mm. It's rare and it requires a lot of hard work. And luck, sure. And you're very quick to recognize the luck, you know?
Well, it's so true. There's so many people who are so deserving of an audience, of being heard, who for whatever reason have not had that exposure. And I think luck plays a huge part in how we get to where we get to in our lives. Mm-hmm. But one thing I wanted to talk about briefly is this, you know, there's such ageism in our business. And it was a few years ago, I think it was, where I read a really beautiful interview that my friend Lucinda Williams gave on her career. And she was so unapologetic, so forthright, strong in her declaration that she's never been as good as she is right now as a songwriter, as a performer, as an artist. Her tools that she brings to the process have never been as sharp.
All of it was part of getting her here.
Right. She has invested years and years and years and years and years into where she has arrived to now. And she's declaring it. But she's declaring, this is what I believe about what I do. And this is how much I believe. And I should. Damn it, I should. And I was so inspired by her declaration. And I just have never forgotten it. It was just like, it was this moment in time, an older woman saying, I'm fucking good at what I do. And I'm not afraid to shout it. It resonated with me so much. It takes us such a long time to become, like, we know how to do what we do. You're a craftsman and you have learned your craft. And when you feel that, there's no way to describe the euphoria that comes with it. That makes sense.
Yeah, and that, so much so. And also that can be what a legacy is, is the approach to the craft, right? Like to be known for taking your craft that seriously, to be known for creating work that continues to challenge and surprise and also comfort. Mm. Legacy is as much to me about looking forward as it is about looking back.
Yes, right? Indeed. Well said.
And I think that it is to acknowledge both all that you have done and created and worked on to be able to be here at a moment where you, all of that has informed your ability to make this album, and then this album and everything you're pouring into it is informing the way that you step into the next and the next and the next. And the fact that that's the way you work and that's the way you see it and the way that you're still 17 with your arm out the window of the car going down the highway is, I think, part of what is readable in your music and part of what is readable in your approach and a part of what people respond to, I think. I am sure it is easier for people to think, now there's somebody who is larger than life and has it figured out. And, you know, the way when I hear that music, it sounds like it comes from a well of wisdom that is beyond the average mortal's reach, right? So for someone who has that version of you in their head to have a moment where they get to hear from the you that also is worried about running out of time the way we're all worried about running out of time. Mm-hmm. And the you that has imposter syndrome and the you that has to write a lot of bad songs before a good one mm-hmm. comes up again. Mm. That's a you that, you know, you don't have any obligation mm-hmm. to share with the world. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so choosing to is very generous.
I've spent so many years, you know, putting records out and promoting records and talking about what I've been doing and so forth. And we were able to go beyond that and talk about so many different things and have a creative conversation. And it's the conversation that I have been hungry for all of these years.
Oh,
and
that's so kind.
I just want to thank you.
This has been so much fun. This has been such a delight. It has been a joy of my life, really. I will get to tell people that I got to sit in a closet and talk about songwriting with Mary Chapin Carpenter, and we giggled about what we giggled about, and we talked about what was heavy and needed talking through, and people get to hear this new album, and I feel very lucky.
I haven't spent this amount of time talking about poetry and music and the creative process and life and useless days and all the things that we have touched on. I haven't ever had such an extraordinarily wonderful and gratifying time doing this as I have with you, and I can't thank you enough.
The Dirt and the Stars will be released on August 7th. One Story is produced by Jesse Baker and Eric Newsom at Magnificent Noise. Our production staff includes Hiwate Gatana, with a special thanks to Carla Sachs and Chris Tetzeli. I'm Sarah Kay. Thanks for listening.